first, I want to start off by just saying this prayer here. It says, God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, the 12 steps, the big book, the meetings, my disease, and you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please help me see the truth. All right, with that prayer being said, my name is John Eichmann. I'm definitely alcoholic. I say that I'm definitely alcoholic every time that I speak, anywhere that anyone asks me to speak, even at my home group, people are tired of hearing me say it. And I say it repeatedly over and over again, because when I first showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous, I raised my hand and I said I was an alcoholic because that's what you guys did. You know, when you guys shared, you'd say, hi, my name's Bill, or I'm Greg, or I'm Joe, or this is Missy, and I'm an alcoholic. And I just wanted to fit in somewhere so bad when I got here that I did that, not knowing what it actually meant to suffer from alcoholism and to admit to being an alcoholic. I didn't find that out until in 2011, a guy took me through this process. And I started to say that I'm definitely an alcoholic because I finally understood. Now, I need to give you the forewarning that I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a couple years before I actually found out that there was literature, before I had found out that there was 12 steps that we were supposed to be doing. You know, I viewed Alcoholics Anonymous as like this therapy session that we showed up to. We drank crappy coffee. We talked about how crappy our day was. The guy didn't let me go 50 cents on the bus, and now my whole day's ruined, and we collected time. That's what I thought this was about. I thought it was about collecting time. And the story that I bring, what occurs in my life, by the time I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, I just want to stop going to jail and stop going to rehab, and I just want to be a normal person in life, right? A friend of mine, Jose, talks about, you know, being up drinking all night long and then peeking out the windows as the sun's coming up and seeing normal people go to work and saying, man, I just wish I could do that. How do they do that? And, you know, it starts for me very young, a very young age. I'm not here to tell you if we cross some imaginary line, if we were born alcoholic. I don't really get into all that, and people have different opinions on all that, and I really don't get into that. What I can tell you is I had signs of alcoholism well before I picked up my first drink. The way that I grow up in a family of, it's kind of like a broken home. I have an older brother and an older sister. They have a different father than me. And then, I have a father who leaves, and then I'm growing up with this stepfather. I have two, older brother and an older sister who are from a different father. So it's real easy for me at a young age to separate myself. Nobody understands me. Nobody knows what it's like to be me, right? They don't get it. Every other weekend, my brother and sister get dropped off at their real father's house, right? And then I feel like I'm alone. And I don't know about any of you guys, but for me, I suffer from this thing where I constantly have all these fears running around in my head, and they're telling me that I'm not good enough, telling me I'm not going to be good enough. I shouldn't have did that. I should have did this, right? I don't know if any of you guys suffer from that. Maybe I'm just crazy and these people were right all along. But what I've come to find out is the only reason I talk about my older brother and older sister is because they don't sit in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. They weren't born like I was born, right? My brother, when he was getting married, we went out for a nice dinner. We had a steak dinner, and he's asking the waiter what wine pairs well with steak. And then he left like a half a glass of wine on the table. And I'm looking at him like, are you really going to – that was like a $10 glass to wine. Are you going to leave that there? What are you doing? You know, because I don't understand that. My sister's the type of person who she gets off from her manager job at Rite Aid on Friday afternoon. She starts drinking. Sunday night at some time, she flips this switch and says, that's it. I'm not having any more. And she goes back to work on Monday like normal people do. See, a guy like me, I start drinking on Friday. And then like 3 weeks later, people are like, hey, have you seen John? Does anybody know where he is? And then people who love me, like my mom, are calling institutions and jails and morgues trying to find me. Because I just disappear. I just go off the grid. I disappear. And that's the way it is, you know, and the only reason I bring up my older brother and older sister is because they are not like us. They can have a few drinks and go back to work. They can have a few drinks and decide that they're done. For a guy like me, once I start and I open up that cage, I just can't put the beast back into the cage. It doesn't go back in, until I'm removed from the situation. And you'll hear throughout my story, a common occurrence is that I'm plucked off the street, which I believe to be by God, and I'm placed in these facilities where I get really close to God, and then they decide to let me back out because I'm doing pretty well, And when I get released back into the wild, that's exactly what I do. I go back into the wild. I start living off of self again. And I go back to the things that I do, frequenting the places that I do. And, as a kid in like middle school, I remember locking myself in the bathroom. See, I have a older brother and an older sister who would get me ready for school because my mom would be gone for work by the time we got up. And I would lock myself in the bathroom and be worried about, like, is this a good enough outfit? Are they going to look at me funny? You know, I'm constantly worried about what you guys are thinking about me, what you're going to say about me. I'm so self-absorbed. And it brings on these bouts of, like, crippling fear. And when the people around you love you the way that the people around me love me, they take you to places like psychiatrists and psychologists because they think that there's something wrong with you when you – you know, our literature talks about us not being honest with doctors and psychiatrists. But even when we are honest with doctors and psychiatrists, when I show up at a psychiatrist's office and he says, well, what's going on? And I say, I'm constantly full of fear. I'm always worried about what everyone's thinking about me, right? They start getting their prescription pad out and they go, yeah, you have high anxiety or you have this and you have that. And what I've come to find out is the untreated symptoms of alcoholism that are described on page 52 to a doctor sound a lot like bipolar disorder, depression, sounds a lot like anxiety. And what they start to do is they prescribe me all these different medications like they put me on like Tegretol and Depakote and I'm checking white blood cell levels and they – diagnosed me with ACC and ADD and ODD and like ACDC, all these different labels they're putting on me. And the problem is for true mental health patients, when they give them those medications, it starts to change the chemical dependency in their brain and then they go back to being normal. But for me, they write me these prescriptions and a month later, I'm going back to the doctor. I'm saying whatever you gave me doesn't work. It doesn't fix the problem, right? I'm still constantly full of fear. I'm always worried about what people are saying about me, right? I'm always telling myself I'm not going to be good enough. Some days I'm up, some days I'm down, right? And what I come to find out is summer going from 7th to 8th grade, I find the one medication that will fix all that problem, and it's alcohol. I remember exactly where I was. It was about 22 years ago. I could tell you exactly who I was with, where I was at, what we were drinking. We were behind the Bridesburg Boys and Girls Club in Northeast Philadelphia. There was about 4 or 5 of us there. My friend Tommy's older sister, Mary, got us a case of Michelob Ponies. And we were behind the Boys and Girls Club drinking these Michelob Ponies. And somewhere about number 3 or number 4, I started to feel completely different than I had ever felt in my entire life. No longer was I worried about what people were saying about me, what people thought about me. I thought that I was the life of the party. I was the funniest guy there. And it felt great to be free. I don't know if any of you guys suffer from the thing that I'm talking about where the mind is constantly telling you you're not good enough and you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. It's like being trapped in a cage in your own mind. And when I had those 3 or 4 Michelob Ponies, I was free. It was like I could breathe and, I felt great. And, what happens for me is like, I'd love to tell you I was a blackout drinker from the beginning, but what happens for me is like, I'm the guy who now it's my mission to set up how we're going to drink, where we're going to drink, right? Like, hey, Sam, make sure that you do all of your chores because Gary's parents are going down to the shore this weekend and we're going to get together over there and Donald's uncle is going to get us the alcohol, right? And this is what my Monday through Friday is consumed with. And then when the school lets out on Friday, I'm drinking from Friday to Sunday until I go back to school on Monday. And, this is what my life starts to be like. And what happens is the people around me love me enough to see that there's a problem there. And my 8th grade graduation, I missed because I was in my first treatment center. Now that's how rapidly the progression happened for me. I found alcohol this summer going from 7th to 8th grade. And I found alcohol in the beginning of 8th grade, and by my 8th grade graduation, I was already in my first 30-day detox. And, you know, when you're like 16, 17 years old, they don't think that this has got to be some alcohol problem. So they label you with all these things, these mental health diagnoses, and they start prescribing you all these different medications because there's no way you're at 16 years old suffering from alcoholism. But that's my story because I sit here today. I'm 36 years old. I haven't taken any medications, mood or mind altering substances since May 31st, 2011. And, I don't need those medications. I don't suffer from ADD and ODD and bipolar depression. What I believe that was missing in my life was this connection with the creator. I believe in my heart, which I didn't know at the time. I was just roaming around aimlessly looking for something, and I just never knew what it was. So back to my story, I missed eighth grade graduation, and things go pretty well. I somehow skate through ninth grade. In 10th grade, I'm showing up to school every day smelling like Boone's Farm liquor. And the teachers really don't like that. So what they're doing is they're either calling my parents or they're sending me home. I'm getting suspended. I'm getting in a lot of trouble. So in 10th grade, I had the scales of justice, right? And on this side, I have what I'm getting from alcohol. And on this side, I have what I'm getting from school. And what I'm getting from alcohol outweighs far what I'm getting from school. And I know some guys who are roofers and who they don't have any high school education. So you know what? I think I'll be okay. And at 10th grade, I decided to drop out of school. And that comes back later to bite me. But I drop out of school. And when you have nowhere to go and you're in 10th grade, you start committing crimes to do the things that I want to do, drinking. And I'm not going to bore you with a lot of war story, right? My life from when I dropped out of high school in 10th grade until when I got sober at 28 years old was the same thing exactly described in the doctor's opinion. This is repeated over and over unless this person can have an entire psychic change. And what it looks like for me is I drink until I can't take drinking anymore. Right. And I feel like I want to kill myself. And I end up in like an AA meeting somewhere. Right. And I try to sit in your guys' AA meetings because I feel like there's some type of problem. But I told you guys earlier that when I showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt like it was just this. I felt like it was this therapy session where I was just there to share about my problems, right? And I would sit holding on to the chair and like all that goofy stuff that people tell you, just try to make 90 meetings in 90 days and heading over to the diners and stuff like that afterward. The problem for me is like Gary legitimately is smiling and is happy, right? And inside, somewhere in the middle of the meeting in my mind, it's like, screaming, shut up. I hate you. Why are you happy? Why can't I be happy? I hate it here. I hate life. And what happens is I develop this complex that I think that I'm so messed up that even AA can't help me. And I continue to commit crimes, which I get arrested for. And this is the carousel that I'm living my life of. Get locked up, get released, go to drinking, try AA, leave AA, go back, get locked up, and it's just like this big circle. Right? My sober mind has a theme song of the circus. It's just craziness. And what happens for me is I'm just like Bill in his story when he talked about for a brief moment I needed and wanted God. Every single time they were putting those handcuffs on me, I needed and wanted God. Please, God, help me, right? And I'm sure that I said prayers before that. I grew up in a Presbyterian home. My mom took me to Sunday school. My mom took me to church. I learned about God as I was growing up. But I remember every time that I got locked up, I would always be involved. I would get my Bible. I'd get the rosary, and I would be going to church, and I would be praying, and I would be heavily involved, and then they would let me back out. And I would say, oh, here, you must need this Bible because you're going to be here in jail. I'm leaving, right? And I would leave God right inside of jail every time that I left. And I would go back to living on self. And in 2010, I was arrested again. I was back incarcerated. And, I was listening to they have like loudspeakers in jail for anyone who's never been in long-term placement in jail. And they were calling church, right? And every Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, they called church, and I was ready to go to church, and I was getting ready to go down there. And on that particular Sunday morning, I heard them say AA, right? And it was at 9:30. And I was like, you know, I would love to tell you guys that I was like, I'm going to get sober. This is going to be great, right? But the reason I went to that AA meeting that day was because if there was anyone that snuck anything inside this jail, it was you guys. And I was going to find out who had something good, and I was going to get it from them because the thoughts just are overpowering when I'm locked up and I can't stop. And, I go down to this AA meeting, and it's the first time I see the 11th tradition in action. And I have no clue at this time what the 11th tradition is, right? That attraction rather than promotion. I remember the meeting, the first meeting of this guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, just like I remember that first drink that I had. His name was Steve S., and he was from the Ridley Beginner Step Meeting. Ridley is a small little township right outside of Philadelphia. And I'll never forget that guy because he showed up at the meeting. He was on time. He spoke in a way about alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous that I had never heard anyone speak before. And he carried these little big books in his pocket, right? And he was, like, giving out these big books after the meeting. And like I told you guys before, I'm the type of guy who I'm worried what you're thinking about me, what you're saying about me. So if I show up to a literature meeting and we're reading, like, you know how the meeting goes around and Gary reads a paragraph and then he passes it off to Sam and Sam reads a paragraph and then George gets it, right? So I'm like counting the paragraphs and where I'm going to end up. So I can't hear any of the literature that's being spoken about before that. All I can read is my selfish paragraph. And then George reads two paragraphs, and I'm like, wait, you prick, you can't do that. You just messed me all up, right? Because now I'm so consumed with myself, right? And what I find in my life is that fear drives me to do a lot of things that I normally wouldn't do. It's kind of like when you back a cat into a corner. A cat doesn't want to fight you just walking down the street, but if you back a cat into the corner, they'll lash back out and try to fight you. But I do a lot of things in my life, and then I claim this tough guy status later, like I'm this big tough guy. But really, I did things out of fear. And, you know, this guy, Steve S., shows up. He's giving out these big books in the jail. I receive a copy of the big book, and I would love to tell you that as soon as I touched the big book, it changed my whole entire life. I'm sure you guys had people come to your podium at your home group, right? Like, terrible story, terrible life. They touch the big book. The Holy Grail changes their life, right? I dropped out of school in 10th grade. I received the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not going to lie to you. I still had like 20 more months left on my sentence. I threw it on the shelf. I've been incarcerated so many times. I've read every single James Patterson book, like Roses Are Red, Violets Are Blue, The Big Bad Wolf, Flood the Bridge, like everything he's ever written. Stephen King, right? I've read every book that the cell block that I'm on has to offer, and I'm left with the Bible and the big book, right? And I'm like, well, I'm you know, a good Christian guy. I'm going to pick my Bible back up, and I start reading the Bible as if it's a novel, and I'm in the beginning in Genesis, and then he begot this son who begot that son, and I close up the Bible, and I slide it back across the table. And I pick up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will tell you that it started to change my life because I started to get an understanding of what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous actually was. For years, I thought we came, we shared crappy stories, and we just gathered time. And what the book was telling me was there was things that I had to do. But like I told you, I dropped out of school in 10th grade, so I come across words like phenomenon, right? And it's phenomenon, but I can't read, so I think it says phenomenon. And I just keep going. I make up my own definition of what that means, because God forbid I ask anyone for help. I keep getting to this place in the book where it says we were now at step three, and I'm shaking my fist at you people in AA that said that I needed one of those sponsor guys, right? Because the book just clearly told me I was on the third step. And this is where my opinion comes into the talk a little bit. Like a lot of people, you hear them say, like, I did my first step experience when I was out there. And I think that that's total crap. I can't do a first step until I actually show up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. A man sits down with me with this blue book right here, and he reads to me what it actually means, what the doctor believes it means to be an alcoholic, right? That I suffer from this allergy that once I start drinking, I can't stop drinking. And even when I stop drinking, I end up going back to the drinking, right? Why is that? And we take a deeper look. And I believe that's when I complete that first step. But I'm in jail and I have no one helping me, and I don't even know what phenomenon means. So I just keep on going. I end up getting out of jail and I go to a treatment center, which is long-term treatment center. And, I would love to tell you this treatment center like changed my life, but nothing happened there. Like it felt like an extended part of my jail stay. And when I left that treatment center, I had manipulated my way into this recovery house that I was familiar with. Cause when you're homeless like me, you bounce in and out a lot of sober homes. And I knew that the owner was just one of those guys that said, if you pay your rent, you'll be okay. Just do whatever you want, right? Because I don't like rules. I don't like you to tell me what I have to do. I just want to be able to do what I want to do. And I manipulate my way into this place, which is in the heart of, you know, the area that I was just hanging out and being active in, which is not a good area. I'm not going to get sober there. And fear for the first time in my life works, right? And one of those stupid little coins, right? A lot of people think they're really stupid little coins. When I left the rehab, they gave me a coin that said that I had completed their program, right? Eagleville Rehabilitation Center. And I was looking at that coin and I was honest with myself in my heart. And I said, I'm not going to be able to stay sober here. And I called one of the only phone numbers that I remember without having a cell phone. The place where I used the phone, it was a Chinese store. And right outside the Chinese restaurant, there was a 10-cent pay phone. I picked up the 10-cent payphone. I made a call to a guy named Bill, and he told me to meet him at 4318 Frankfort Avenue. Now, that address doesn't mean anything to you, right? Like, on that day, it didn't mean anything to me. But to me, nowadays, it means a lot. That's my home group's address, 4318 Frankfort Avenue. And he told me to meet him there, and I thank God that day he didn't say, meet me at the AA meeting, because I would have never went. Because like I told you guys, I thought AA was bullshit. I thought it didn't work, right? And he told me meet him at that address. I met him at that address, and when I saw him, it was like Bill when he saw Ebby. It was undeniable that there was something different about this guy. And I said, whatever you're doing, I just need to be a part of it. And he introduced me to a recovery house, which had all these rules and these mandatory meetings. And Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we had to be at these mandatory meetings, and all these meetings were big book oriented, right? I'm a strong believer in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Big Book was what changed my life in the end. Monday night, we had an in-house Big Book study. This guy would get off of work. He would show up, and he would read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous with us. And right after that Monday night meeting, they went around the room, and they'd say, hey, Donald, who's your sponsor, and what step are you on? And I'm looking around like, can they ask us this, right? Like, this is an anonymous program. You can't ask me about who my sponsor is and what step I was on. And they said, listen, if you want to live here, you're going to tell us who your sponsor is, what step you're on. And if you're on the third step this week, next week when we meet, you better not still be on the third step. And that was the way that I was pushed in recovery. So again, fear works in my life. I see them telling everybody they got to have the sponsor. The very next meeting I was at, there was a guy named Doug S. He was speaking from a podium. He didn't have fancy shirt and tie on or anything like that. Actually, he had like spackle on his shirt. He had like paint on his jeans. He was just a regular everyday dude. He wasn't even supposed to be at that meeting. Someone called him when he was at work, asked him to come speak at that meeting. He showed up. And that guy showing up in Alcoholics Anonymous changed my life. He said something that I'll never forget. He said, when I showed up at AA, I was a broken homeless bum. I just wanted to learn how to pay my bills. And I said, that's my guy right there. I asked him if he would be my sponsor. He told me some of the weirdest things that I've ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, like it would be an honor and a privilege. And then he invited me to his car. I said, I can't come to your car. I'm on blackout. I got to be back around the corner at this house. And again, the 11th tradition, traction rather than promotion. He said, what recovery house do you live at? And I told him where I was living. He picked up the phone. He called the owner of the recovery house. He told him, John's with me. And they said, okay, and hung up the phone. That's how quick the conversation was. And I saw that I wanted to be like that. I wanted that like he was so trustworthy that all he had to do was say, this guy's with me. And it was okay with the recovery house. They knew that I was in good hands. And where I got sober at, it's not a really good neighborhood. It's in North Philadelphia. It's, it's really shady area. Right up the street from my home group, there's like this really like dimly lit parking lot where there's a Family Dollar right off of the main strip. And he used to park his car there because at night, you know, it's like a free parking lot instead of paying the meters out front. And he invites me to his car. We're sitting in this dimly lit parking lot. We're reading the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's asking me some questions. I'm answering some questions. And the next thing I know, he reaches over, he grabs my hand. And I'm like, yo, dude, like, I don't know what you're into, but I don't get down like that, right? Like, this is how my thinking is at the time, right? And I had just come from doing 23 months in jail and a bunch of time in rehab. I'm like, listen, I don't, no disrespect to you, but I don't get down like that. And he was like, no, idiot, we're going to say a prayer. And again, I'm like, real reserved, because where I come from in jail, you don't show people that you pray, right? That's a sign of weakness. People start to get you and they pick on you after that. And, we say what I know now to be the third step prayer. And he told me I should learn that prayer and I should say it every day of my life. And I started to incorporate that. And he told me something really great too. He said, take your shoes and put them. I never did this, not one time either. But after he taught me the prayer, he said, I want you to take your shoes and put them underneath of your bed. So every morning when you get up, you have to get on your knees and reach under your bed to get this. And I said, well, that was really great back in 1980, right? But I have a cell phone and there's an alarm clock on my cell phone. All I have to do is set this alarm and it tells me I should pray every day, right? And, well, that's what I did. I set this alarm clock every day. I knew I got up around like 8 o'clock at the recovery house. I had the alarm set for 8:10 and I used to say the third step prayer exactly how it's written in the book. And he told me I should learn it how it's written in the book. And then he showed me the paragraph where it says that it's okay. The wording is optional. But he said you should learn it the way that it's written so you can teach it later. And something about Doug was that after he taught me steps 1, 2, and 3, he told me I should go tell other people about steps 1, 2, and 3. And I was like, what the hell is this guy talking about? And even people in the circles where we were at in the AA meetings, they told me that I wasn't ready to tell anybody about the steps. I should just sit back, right? All these people were telling me all this stuff. And Doug just kept pointing me back to the book. And he said, look, the book's telling us to be altruistic and go help other people. And then it says right here that if sex is the troublesome, we should go working with others, right? It doesn't say wait until step 12. I want you to go and keep teaching people about steps 1, 2, and 3. And that's what I did. Anybody that would listen, I was like, you want to read the doctor's opinion with me? I'll show you what it says about altruism. And he dropped me back off my recovery house. I wrote the fourth step in one night. I would love to tell you guys like all the steps that I've gone through. You know, I'm sure you guys have been through your own step process. What I do want to do is I want to highlight some things like in the fourth step. In the fourth step, I wrote this resentment list. And when I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous this time, I was 28 years old and I had 28 years worth of resentments that I carried around. See, what I didn't tell you about that childhood when I was growing up is I had a stepfather who was physically abusive. And if he had a bad day at work, when he got home, anyone that was crossing his path was getting it. I there's been nights that I watched my stepfather unload the gun cabinet from one side of the hallway to the other, throwing bullets and handguns at my mom. And I seen a lot of crazy crap when I was growing up, and that man was like a tyrant in my life. And when I show up here, I have a huge resentment towards that man. I hate him. I can't stand him. And if he died tomorrow, it would be the best thing on earth. That's how I feel when I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous. And years ago, if you would have asked me, you know, why I'm an alcoholic, he would have been one of the things I would have offered you. Oh, I was physically abused by my stepfather. He was a tyrant. He beat us, you know, and that would have been one of my outs. And what I found is that I'm an alcoholic because I suffer from the things we were talking about earlier, that spiritual malady, right? That mental obsession. I'm an alcoholic because once I start, I can't stop, that allergy. Not that I had a rough childhood. There's people who were physically abused in their childhood and they didn't turn out to be alcoholics. And that's not what differentiates me. But what happened was I wrote this inventory. I did this fifth step with my sponsor, right? And my mom had invited me back for Thanksgiving dinner. I was invited back to Thanksgiving dinner for the first time in a very long time. When I was 16 years old, I was getting arrested. I was arrested. I was in courtroom and I grabbed my mom by her arms and I shook her in front of everybody in the courtroom. And I was like, you need to get me out of this, you know, spoiled, entitled little kid. And I'm shaking my mom. And when that happened, she made the decision that I was a danger to her health and I should get out of her house. So at 16 years old, she asked me to leave. I wasn't invited back until I was 28. So I'm invited back to this Thanksgiving dinner and I'm on this path. I had met my sponsor. I had been through the first three steps. I wrote a fourth step. I did a fifth step. And I was starting to talk to my sponsor about 6, 7, and 8. And I'm invited to this dinner. I go to this Thanksgiving dinner. Of course, my stepfather has the seat at the head of the table. I'm right next to him. And I envision myself grabbing a knife and stabbing him in his neck. And I'm like, whoa, right? Like, and this is why I love Alcoholics Anonymous, because I say that and I see Gary giggle a little bit, right? Like, you guys relate with that. If I told someone at my job that I had fantasized about killing my stepfather, they would probably get up from the lunch table and move away from me. But you guys are like, oh yeah, I get it. I understand, right? So I call up sponsor and I'm like, yo, like, this is crazy. Like, we're going through these steps and I don't think that I'm supposed to be fantasizing about killing this guy. And he says, no, what you have, son, is a deep resentment. And what you need to do is you need to ask God and get God involved and make that resentment go away. And he taught me the prayers, right? He taught me the prayer on page 67 where I ask God for tolerance, pity, and patience, right? But, you know, a lot of people will come to your home group and tell you the first 164 pages are the most important part of the big book. Page 552, freedom from bondage is the name of the story. That story changed my entire life because my sponsor took me to the back of that book. He showed me on page 552 where it said, if you have a resentment towards someone, you should pray for them, for everything that you want for yourself to be given to them. Even when you don't mean it, you just pray it anyway. And it says that if you continue to pray for this person for 2 weeks, that that'll go away and you'll start to have compassion in your heart. Now, I'm here to tell you that it took a little longer than 2 weeks, but the fourth step is where I believe that the rubber meets the road and it separates the boys from the men. Because if I'm actually doing the prayers that are involved behind a resentment, right? Nowadays, I'm driving my car and someone cuts me off. Am I just quick to flip the bird or am I quick to go to the prayer? What do I have more practice at? But I remember I started to pray for my stepfather and God entered my heart and there was a change. The change that happened was I started to feel compassion for this sick man who, however he grew up, maybe he was mistreated and that's all he knew. I don't know. I'm not sure. But what I know is that at Christmas Eve that same year, only 30 days later, I went and I made amends to my stepfather for the way that I used to wedge myself in between him and my mom's relationship. Because what I used to do and what my sponsor helped me see in the fifth step is that I used to separate my stepfather and my mom and try to get them turned against each other because then it was easier for me to manipulate them and get the things that I wanted to give from them. And that's the type of selfish, inconsiderate person that I am. I'm playing with their relationship just to get meet my own selfish needs. And I was able to go back and make amends to this man for the way that I used to tear their marriage apart and get wedged in between them and make my mom pick me over him. And, you know, what I've come to find out is that, you know, the book says resentment's the number one offender. And that resentment prayer has been one of the most key tools in my arsenal. You know, little over 9 years later, I still have resentments on a daily basis and I can still carry them around and my spirit can be disturbed and I could feel, sick as I'm walking around. I know if you guys are anything like me, when you do something wrong, you feel it. Your spirit says that wasn't right. You shouldn't do that. Right. And, what I was taught from my sponsor is that fundamental idea of God that's deep down in every man, woman, and child that they talk about on page 55 is that right and wrong. You know, when I'm going to steal something, something inside of me says, don't do that. It's not right. And when I steal it and I continue to just meet my own selfish need, later it beats on me. Something inside of me is like, that wasn't right. You need to make it right. You need to go put that back. You need to make that right. And it just wears on my spirit. And if I continue to carry around these resentments long enough, I end up drinking again. And what I need to tell you guys is like, I'm constantly full of fear. So the fear prayer was very huge in my arsenal. I made a lot of really good amends. You know, some amends that I thought were going to go one way, they went the other way. You know, like my brother told me to go F myself and I thought he was going to be like my mom and my sister with the pats on the back and just keep doing what you're doing. Everything is great. But what I do know is, you know, through living this way of life, I learned a lot of lessons and, something that was big for me is like, I need a sponsor, you know, 9 years sober. I still need a sponsor. I still need someone to bounce ideas off of because I can still be emotionally attached to my stuff. And, somewhere around like a year and a half sober, the guy that took me through the steps, he picked up, he went through a divorce. He got away from Alcoholics Anonymous. Suddenly cars and money was more important than helping guys and meetings and stuff like that. He disappeared from AA and I was running around, you know, not sponsored, you know, I was sponsoring a bunch of guys, but I didn't have a sponsor. I'm running around Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm just running on self, you know, just doing all this craziness. And, me and my friend Bill went to pick up a guy who was going to speak for us. He flew in from Las Vegas. We go to pick this guy up, right? And we're driving in the car. And of course, three alcoholics are in the car. We're talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And of course, I'm selfish, so I want to talk about myself, but I don't want him to know that I'm talking about me. So I ask him what he thinks about a guy who had a sponsor take him through the steps, you know, was sponsored for like a year and a half, and then the guy's sponsor picks up. What do you think about that? And Sheldon looks at me and goes, he goes, John, what's the first thing you tell people when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, well, I usually first tell people they should get a sponsor. He said, then why don't you listen to your own advice? You know, my ego had reemerged where I was, you know, I thought because I had a little bit of time sober that, you know, I was okay and I had been through the steps before, you know, but I was still making decisions selfishly. I wasn't calling anybody like, hey, Gary, what do you think I should do about this situation? Or let me tell you about this that happened to me. And then Gary's able to step back, not be emotionally attached to it and say, John, you're an idiot. You should probably go make amends. And what happens is I end up getting a resentment at a guy who said that he was too busy to come speak for us. And it was a completely different guy. And I get a resentment towards this guy. And I'm like, will you believe this guy? And someone else said, well, did you ever call him and just, you know, see what happened? Turns out something tragic happened in his life one day. He just couldn't make it to come speak, right? So I end up asking that guy to be my sponsor. And it turns out that his sponsor was the guy, Sheldon, who was in the car that told me I should listen to my own advice and get a sponsor. And that's the way that God works in my life. Now, years ago, I'd have told you, wow, that's a huge coincidence, right? But nowadays, I tell you that, like, I can look back in hindsight and say, wow, look at God's fingerprints all over that beautiful picture. You know, it's kind of like that footsteps prayer where I couldn't see that and I thought that I was just carrying along. And it turns out that when I turn around and see, it was just God was carrying me through all that. You know, steps 10, 11, and 12 have been very beneficial in my life when I actually apply them. Because I'm not going to sit here and lie to you guys and say that I sit down every single night and write out inventory. I have really good sponsees like this guy, George, who's on the call somewhere. I'm swiping through looking for him, who are very diligent with the inventory process. And they send me an inventory every single night. And I'm amazed by it because I'm so selfish that I get trapped in my own little world. I have a daughter. I have a job. I have these things going on. And that's the story that I run to myself of why I should just go to sleep instead of writing this inventory, right? But like I told you guys, my 10th step is pretty strong. Something in my spirit tells me it's not right and I make it right as soon as possible. But I'm not going to lie to you guys and tell you I do an inventory every single night. But I do come from a sponsorship family where we believe in once a year revisiting the work, because I'm sure you guys clean your house at home. You clean your house probably once a day, once a week, whatever it is. But how often do you pull out the refrigerator and dust behind there, right? And that's the thinking behind, like, yeah, we do a 10th and 11th step and we're pretty good at it, but we don't get it all the time. So what we do is once a year, we do this personal house cleaning. And that's what that's what I've passed on to the guys that I sponsor. You know, we sit down, we do a new fourth and a new fifth step. We try to be very thorough at least once a year. And the 12th step is the most amazing thing that I've experienced in my entire life. The 12th step has changed my life. You know, when I was in that rehab for 91 days, they had an intern. Her name was Kate. And, Kate was supposed to teach like a group that day. And it was come to find out now, it was Kate's first ever group she was ever going to handle. And, she decided she wanted to teach us about altruism. And I told you guys, I dropped out of school in 10th grade. So I'm scared by big words like altruism, right? And I don't want you to call on me like the teachers used to do to me in school. Cause I would play games in the back of the class and not pay attention. And the teacher would call on me and say, hey, John, what's the answer? And I look like a big idiot because I haven't been paying attention. I was afraid that that was going to happen again. And I thought Kate was going to call on me and ask me to tell her what altruism was. And, what I ended up doing was I started to mock her and make fun of her and tell her to get out of here with her college educated words. And then I rile up the guys next to me and I get them going. This intern leaves the group crying. She's trying to teach us about what I find to be the most important thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. But because my ego and my fear, I make fun of this lady and drive her out of the classroom, right? And, you know, there was a time in my life in 2013 where my wife and I were pregnant. We had been trying to conceive for like a year before that. We finally got pregnant. And we were far enough along where I had like the heartbeat as my ringtone on my phone. And in May of 2013, we lost that baby and I was like devastated, right? And what I believe is that the 12th step is what, you know, saved my life, pulled me out of that, because I'm really good at self-pity. Poor me, and sit back and just be in my house. I just want to be left alone. I don't want to go to your stupid Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And when something like that happens in your life, it's really easy to question God and be devastated and say, where were you then? And my human mind will never grasp the concept of God and what his plan is and what's going on and all the moving parts and pieces that are involved. So I had no clue. But when I sit and I question all that, right, it disturbs my relationship with God. And what happens is the people in my home group love me so much that whenever there's a commitment for like a friend's hospital commitment or a detox commitment, what they're doing is they're signing me and my wife's name up and they're sending us the information, saying, hey, you got to be here at 6 o'clock on Tuesday. Or we used to live in an apartment right down the street from our home group, and people would say, oh, you're looking for a sponsor? Go to this address and knock on the door or call this guy, right? And that's the type of people we had around us in Alcoholics Anonymous. They loved us so much that they could see we were in pain. They could see we were hurting, and they rallied around us without actually, you know, jumping in and intervening. They did it in the right way. I believe it was all God-driven. And what happens is we end up throwing ourselves into service, and we get through that. And in 2016, in 2015, we got pregnant again, and now my little daughter's running around. I just had her in the pool, and it's a great way of life. I believe that this right here, what I'm doing here, speaking for this meeting, I believe that this is just service. This is just my service. This is me living out my end of the third step deal that I made with God. I'm here to tell you guys how God has transformed my life. He came into my heart, changed my life, removed resentments, pushed me to do things that I would normally not do. And the 12th step for me is when I see a guy like George move to Philadelphia from Delaware because he's got 10 years of not being able to figure it out. He's in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. He thinks Alcoholics Anonymous is bull crap. And I see myself in him, right? And he doesn't even want me to sponsor him. He's looking for some other guy, right? Like some like Philadelphia circuit speaker guy. He like wants that guy to be a sponsor. And what I do is we're at my home group, the Northeast Club of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're at the anniversary, and every year they have like a huge celebration. They have a speaker, and then they have like a dance party afterwards. They have a DJ, everyone's dancing, food, fun, fellowship, whatever. So I invite him at that meeting, at that dance, if he wanted to come upstairs and read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he doesn't know it, but I'm trying to sponsor him. I'm like trying to jump in on him. And we go upstairs and we start reading the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the next thing we know, this third guy pops into the room and he says, what are you doing? We said, we're just reading the book. And he sits down and he starts reading with us. And the next thing you know, there's 35 people in this big book study, and there's a dance going on downstairs, right? And me and him have talked after that, and we, again, believe that that's the power of God, right? There's a dance going on downstairs with food and fun and fellowship, but the craving for the spiritual learning that we have inside of us, it's drawing people upstairs, and they're coming upstairs and going, what the hell's going on up here? And we're like, it's just a big book study, there's no format. We're just reading the book here and just sharing however you feel. And the next thing we know, there's 35 people sitting in this meeting while there's a free dance going on downstairs. It was pretty amazing stuff. But to watch a guy like him come in and be homeless and have nothing, right, and start to do these steps and go and make amends and help his mom move when she needs to move, right, and just show up in her life, like that's the gift that I've been given. That is just, it's amazing to me, right? And to be able to watch him grow in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the literature talks about how this is an experience you must not miss. Watching people come in and change their life is like the most beautiful thing. I can't really see it in my own life as it happens. You know, I'm one of those guys that have the educational variety of the spiritual experience. It's always when I look back in my life, I can see how God was working. I never really see it as it's happening. But I remember when I started to apply God in my life with this resentment towards my stepfather, I remember my mom one time saying, "There's just something different about you." And that was the first time in my recovery where I looked back and said, wow, like this is working. This something's happening here. And I couldn't wait to like, I wanted to go out front of my meeting at my home group. I wanted to be out front with like a microphone and like a speaker thing and be like, "Hey, come in, Alcoholics Anonymous works. You'll never believe it." I heard a friend of mine say this and it opened me up to saying it too. I would pull up at like a light, and if someone was panhandling, had like a sign, I'd be like, "Do you got an alcohol problem? Do you want to go to treatment?" Like, I'm trying to get like homeless people off the street, right? Like, because that's what happened for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. God entered my heart and it lit me on fire. And I couldn't wait to go and tell other people about it. Somewhere around like 5 years, I had like a lull where I was heading down. But that's the same time I was telling you guys that I was running around without a sponsor. You know, I'm just living, running on self, right? Like I started that meeting over there and I'm the one who gets all the speakers for this meeting, right? Like I had allowed my ego to creep into my Alcoholics Anonymous. I do believe heavily in sponsorship. I sponsor other men. I do believe heavily in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Since I've gotten sober, at my home group, you had to have 1 year sober before you could actually, facilitate the big book studies that they do. You had to have at least 1 year sober. That was a requirement. Since I've been 1 year sober, I have done a big book study somewhere in Alcoholics Anonymous. If it wasn't at my home group and I was in spirit of rotation, I would go to another group and do a big book study. Or where I live, there's a lot of recovery houses, a lot of sober homes. So if you don't see me in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I'm usually doing big book studies in the sober homes. That's a lot of fun because you get to see a lot of guys who are brand new in recovery who have no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous really is. Like I was when I first got here, they think it's like a therapy session, and you get to help them along the way and try to help them find sponsorship and some type of steps. If you're new here, please get involved, get a sponsor, get involved in the steps. It's very important. I just want to read something because Bill told me I had to leave some time for you guys. I just want to read one thing out of the book. This is my favorite paragraph in the whole entire book. It says here that we abandon ourselves to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you guys very much for listening. Thanks for having me.